No, it cannot be!
Hello and welcome to The Backside of Water, a podcast that delves into the rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details behind your favorite Disney attractions. I'm Alex Stewart.
And I'm Harrison, the stout of heart, vanquisher of dragons, slayer of whipped dolls, destroyer of cinnamoned churros, keeper of the realms of adventure and frontier, defender of maidens fair.
Harry, why are you talking like that? And more importantly, why are you dressed in a full suit of armor?
Okay, those are both fair questions. Well, Al, you see, I haven't been sleeping so great lately, so my doctor suggested I talk and dress like this to see if it helps me get a good night's sleep.
That sounds like you might need a new doctor.
I'll have you know that Doc McStuffins attended only the finest schools of medicine, and I will be cursed to the deepest realms of Helm's Deep before I allow you to tarnish her good name, you cad!
No, dude, calm down. But it does sound like you need a good night's sleep, judging from the way things are going. But it's also appropriate that you're wearing that suit of armor because it totally fits with the topic of this episode. And let me also just say that I've got great joy writing this episode because on a backside of the backside of water, Harrison was known for his stand-up that he used to perform back in the day. And one of his opening jokes was this very joke about wearing a suit of armor to get a good night's sleep.
I like to sleep in a full suit of yeah, that's right. I like to sleep in a full suit of medieval armor to get a good night's sleep. I told that on a comedy club that was really rough and tumble. And let me tell you, they had no appreciation for a good, clean pun.
It was beautiful. Did you actually get that I wrote there. That in there as a tribute to your days of yore, Harry?
Oh, I fully did. Impossible to miss. And I tip my knight's hat to you, a rusty tip of the squeak of my knight's visor.
Well, thank you. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, but and it really is a happy little accident that I happen to be wearing a full suit of medieval armor right now. Because on this episode, which is the 30th episode of The Backside of Water, we finally reached our 30s. We will be covering the gold top spires of Sleeping Beauty Castle.
I'm not going to lie. Personally, this is one of the absolute highlight episodes when it comes to researching. I mean, I learned so much about the castle that I never knew before, and it made me appreciate it all that much more.
That's what's so great about Disney attractions and this podcast is you're like, anything, like with a poo ride, you're like, well, whatever, what could be interesting here? And you learn about it, and there is so much rich history.
Oh, it's amazing.
So let's jump in and explore the hallowed halls of the iconic Sleeping Beauty Castle. And folks, stay tuned for an announcement at the end of the episode.
The story of Sleeping Beauty Castle reaches all the way back to World War I.
Wait. World War I? This is in Disneyland.
Well, you believe it or not. So, Harry, it's time for a little bit of a history lesson. So, during World War I, every hot-blooded American male considered it an honor to go off and fight for his country. And Walt Disney, of course, was no exception to that rule. He dreamed, like many of his peers, of carrying the flag of freedom across war-torn Europe. But young Walt kept encountering problem after problem, getting in the way of him and his patriotic dreams. Walt initially tried to sign up for the Navy, but they rejected him for being too young. At that time, Walt was only 16 years old, and the minimum enlistment age was 70. So he and a friend by the name of Russell Maas decided to try the Canadian route and sign up for the Canadian Armed Forces. But Maas was rejected.
Man.
Yeah, he was rejected.
Walt and Russell, signing up for the Canadian Armed Forces to do their part. I don't know if it gets much more just adorable than that. This is like what, like 1918 or something.
It would be pretty precious to watch these two.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it never happened because Maas was rejected due to poor eyesight. Walt didn't want to leave his friend behind, which is a funny irony in the end. So they didn't enlist through the Canadian route either.
And young Walt Disney may have had many obstacles in his way, but he wasn't going to let this stop him. Through his searching for loopholes, Walt discovered that he could join the Red Cross Ambulance Corps, and they had lower age requirements in the military. So Moss and Disney, aka Russ and Walt, posed as the St. John brothers and attempted to join the Red Cross. But due to their age of 16, the Red Cross required that the St. John boys get signed permission from their parents to enlist. This was going to be a problem. Walt and Russell had every intention of forging the documents themselves, as they knew their parents would never do it. After all, parents back then weren't any crazier about sending their children off to war than parents of today. The two boys plotted their plans and began to prepare for their soiree into military life.
But one day, Moss's mother found a partially packed suitcase in her son's room and started to suspect that something was up. She alerted Flora Disney, Walt's mother, about the suitcase and warned her that the boys might be planning a midnight escape. Now, three of Flora's sons had left home in the middle of the night, and she was determined not to let another one slip away in the same manner. So she approached her husband, Elias, Walt's father, and asked him to sign the release forms allowing their son to join the Red Cross. Elias, being such a staunch pacifist, refused to sign what he believed to be his son's death certificate. So Flora forged his signature and sent Walt on his way. Walt was elated. He was going to join the Red Cross. But when he turned in his paperwork, he discovered there was a problem with his age. He had heard that the Red Cross wasn't too particular about age, but unfortunately, he was mistaken. Walt was told by the Red Cross that he was too young to enlist. Walt had had it by this point. He got a pin and turned the one in his 1901 birth date into a zero. In one stroke of that pin, Walt turned from 16 to 17 and enlisted in the Red Cross Ambulance Corps.
Wow. Well, folks, the real lesson here is that one is the easiest number to turn into any other number. It's just a vertical line. Maybe that will help you out in a bizarre situation down the road. So, now, young Walt Disney was on his way to fulfill his civic duty by helping his fellow brothers fight against the evils that confronted them overseas. During his training, though, Walt contracted influenza and was sent home to recover. While in recovery, Russell Moss and Walt's ambulance division would be shipped overseas, leaving a sick Walt behind.
Sorry, can I just jump in and say that's where I think that sick irony is Walt was like, I'm not going to join the Canadian side because Russell can't do it. But apparently Russell had no problem just leaving poor, sick Walt Disney behind to go off and fight.
He's just looking for adventure. Old
Touché.
Russell. Yeah, well, and I'm really glad that Walt lived through influenza at the time, because at the time, influenza was a big deal. Like that.
Oh, yeah.
I think that, yeah, it was... So he recovered, and no thanks to Russell. But after Walt's recovery, Walt was transferred to a new division where he awaited deployment. But on November 11th, 1918, at 11 o'clock a.m., Walt's dreams of fighting overseas were abruptly crushed with the signing of an armistice. But not all was lost. Just a week after the signing of the armistice, Walt and 50 others from his division were enlisted to go overseas and help with relief and rebuilding efforts.
Walt was thrilled to be shipped overseas to help his fellow man on the European front. But when he got there, he and all his fellow compatriots were greeted by freezing weather, inedible food, and a war-ravaged countryside. This reality of World War I was nothing like the World War I that Walt had envisioned while back in the States. To make matters worse, Walt wasn't assigned to help out with the ambulance drives. Instead, he was tasked with driving around dignitaries and playing a tour guide of sorts for them as they traveled from place to place.
Interesting. Well, it was here that Walt met a man who would have a profound impact on Disneyland, Roland E. Hill. Hill, an Ohio native born in 1895, was a World War I dogfighter who was shot down in battle. After being shot down, Hill joined the motor pool where he drove around military officials much like Walt. During these drives through France and Germany, Hill would sketch the beautiful and sprawling castles he would see along the way. Sometime in 1919, Hill and Walt's path crossed. They were both artists and they bonded over Hill's sketch of the European castles. The two men eventually parted ways, but those drawings and the friendship created with Hill would forever impact Walt Disney.
Now, let's fast forward a little over two decades. Hill and Walt both eventually moved to Los Angeles, and Hill began consulting Walt about the castles in Walt's films. Hill was most famously a consultant in the design for the castles in Snow White, and eventually became known as the foremost castle expert in all of Hollywood.
Wow. So then in the 1950s, Walt contacted who else? The castle expert, Hill, about helping him create something that the two had never created before. Walt was going to build a castle in an orange grove in Anaheim, and Hill was the perfect man for the job. Walt and Hill excitedly worked to create a beautiful and towering castle right in the middle of Orange County. The two drew inspiration from a few castles in Europe, but they received most of their inspiration from Neuschwanstein Castle in Germany. I might not be pronouncing that right.
No, I think you killed that.
I'm, like, weirdly good at German words.
I was going to say, I love that you can't pronounce some of the most arbitrary words, but Neuschwanstein just rolled out like nothing. Well done.
No problem. I think that's called a savant. So Neuschwanstein Castle stands at 213 feet tall at its highest point, but Walt knew a 213-foot tall castle would mess up the scale of his park. So he and Hill used some Hollywood magic to help them out. Also wanted to say that the Neuschwanstein Castle is a little intimidating, and I think maybe Walt, you want to see it, but it kind of also says stay away. And Walt kind of had that challenge in his castle and designing it to make something that was approachable to people. So,
oh, absolutely. I think that's a really good point to bring up, because the last thing that you want to do is have the focal point of the first thing that people see coming into your park be this massive, intimidating, and terrifying-looking structure staring back at them. So,
right.
Yeah.
A structure designed to intimidate peasants is not what you want in the middle of your park.
Well, and I think that it also brings up the big point about the Disneyfication of things, where we've talked about that on the show before. This is another one of those great examples that Walt Disneyfied a very daunting and intimidating structure to make it look more fairy tale, make it look more inviting and more welcoming for those who came into the park. And when one of the ways that he did that was he employed the concept of something called forced perspective to make the castle seem 213 feet tall, even though they built it at a height of 77 feet, which blows my mind that castle is only 77 feet tall.
Oh, I know. It seems so much bigger in my mind.
Oh, it seems massive. Now, Walt would also have Imagineers install a working drawbridge, even though it would only get little use. In fact, the drawbridge has only been lifted twice, once on opening day of the park on July 17, 1955, and again at the rededication of Fantasyland in 1983. This is one of those places where crazy Disney purists are like, well, it's a drawbridge, but it's not a working drawbridge, because now they've made it a permanently down structure because of the railings that they've put on there. So essentially, if they were to take those permanently adhered railings off the side to satisfy ADA requirements and safety problems, it could actually be a working, operating drawbridge again, which is pretty awesome, in my opinion.
I'm sure it will happen at some point in the park's future. You just don't have a drawbridge that you never open or lower or raise. I'm sure it'll happen again. Well, during construction of the park, a surveyor planted a large golden spike in the ground within the arches of Sleeping Beauty Castle.
I've actually heard this. It's to mark the geographic center of the park, right?
Well, that's what a lot of people believe, though that is actually false information.
Bum, bum, bum.
In reality, this golden spike was planted to ensure that Sleeping Beauty Castle's large bridge and entrance lined up with Main Street, USA.
So that begs the question, where is the geographical center of the park then?
Well, it's in a place that really isn't all that remarkable. Before the creation of Toontown, the geographical center of the park is where everyone assumed it would be, the hub where the partner statue, that's the statue of Walt and Mickey holding hands, is located. But now that Toontown exists, the center point is somewhere in between the partner statue and the entrance to Fantasyland. And sadly, there is no mark or anything that denotes the center location of the park, and I'm sure with the addition of Star Wars Land that the center will be different as well.
That's a very good point. I would imagine that it's going to be closer to some place around Big Thunder Mountain.
Mm-hmm. Which is fine with us.
Agreed. It really is a bummer, though, that it's no longer there, but I'm glad that we're actually able to clear up all that confusion. I can't tell you how many times I've seen that falsely advertised in even Disney-sanctioned videos. That you'll see people who come to the park and do these videos and they're there with the permission of Disney falsely represent that. I think, though, that it's also just a little fun thing that they still allow in order to give people something to talk about.
It's fun to believe, sure.
No, I agree.
It's just not true.
Well, and the interior of this attraction also has a pretty detailed history, right?
Believe it or not, the interior design of Sleeping Beauty Castle originally didn't house any attraction, nor was there any plan to use the space for an attraction. But over time, Walt decided that there was a need for that space to be used. So Imagineers were tasked with coming up with something for that empty space.
Now, through much discussion, it was decided that a walkthrough would be the most logical choice for that space. Imagineers began creating a walkthrough that told the story of Sleeping Beauty. On April 29, 1957, visitors would be introduced to this beautifully crafted walkthrough attraction.
During this walkthrough, guests would be introduced to the innovative, iconic, and just plain amazing art stylings of Disney legend Ivan Earle. Ivan Earle was yet another fascinating individual who deserves major airtime on this show. Earle was born in 1916 in New York. His family moved to California when he was very young, where his father thrived as an artist, musician, and filmmaker. Earle's mother was also artistically inclined, as she was a pianist. So it came as no surprise when young Ivan Earle, surrounded by all this artistic prowess at home, started to show major promise as an artist. His skills were so renowned that by age 14, his work was featured in a major French art exhibition. When I was 14, I don't even know what to tell you, but I was really into Mountain Dew Code Red. That was my big accomplishment. Of course, Ivan was getting major accolades from the art world and really raising eyebrows with his beautiful work. So by the time he was 19, his work was exhibited in New York City and beyond.
So eventually, Earle went on to design, as a side gig, greeting cards. He was majorly successful in this field as well, having designed more than 800 cards for the American Artist Group. Now, this is a crazy number. Wow. Because he estimates that by the mid-1980s, over 300 million of his greeting cards designs had been sold. How crazy is that?
I just love seeing when somebody who's majorly involved in the Disney parks is also majorly involved in another part of pop culture or culture that you have no idea. So maybe the next time you buy a beautiful landscape on a greeting card, it could be an Ivan Earle. You never know.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
300 million of them. That's quite a few.
So, I mean, that's one of those things that maybe we need to do some research on and look and see if there are any of those Earle cards out there and collect them, because you know it's the same guy who did all of the art design for Sleeping Beauty. So that's really cool. He also began working for the Walt Disney Company as a background artist on the movie Peter Pan. He was also the artist, this is really cool to me, for the Little Golden Book adaptation of Peter Pan. Here you have this world-renowned artist who's also working in the Little Golden Book adaptations. I think that's cool.
That is cool.
But he would go on to create backgrounds for many famously experimental pieces for Disney, but his most revered work by far was the work he did on the film Sleeping Beauty. His production design for this film is famous for being some of the best in animation history, actually. Some animation and film critics even recognize Da Vinci-esque references and influences in Earle's work. Needless to say, this man was a true artist. In 1966, Earle would return to his roots as a painter and go on to have a full and vibrant career as an artist, his work to this day hanging in the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Wow. Wow. So in 1998, Ivan received the Winsor McCay Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Animation Field. Though Earle died in 2000, his influence can be seen both inside and outside the park, notably in the art style that graced the dioramas in Sleeping Beauty Castle.
Isn't it amazing to see how much creativity in general surrounds the park, whether it's Imagineers or artists or innovators of any sort? That's what I think is so awesome and what always draws me back to Disneyland.
It really is just a collage of so many fantastic minds. It's one of the things I love so much about the park. But Al, one thing about Earle's story kind of doesn't seem to connect.
What do you mean?
Well, I was thinking the dates are kind of off, right? Because Disneyland opened in 1955 with a Sleeping Beauty castle overlooking the entire park. But Sleeping Beauty, if I remember correctly, didn't come out until 1959. And the walkthrough also came into existence almost 2 years before the film was released as well. Did we mess up our dates or something? Because that's weird, right?
Well, it may seem like that, but if you remember all the way back to our Tarzan's Treehouse episode, Disney has a way of gambling on attractions based on movies that aren't yet released. Now, that's exactly what happened with Sleeping Beauty Castle. Walt and crew anticipated that their 16th animated film would be such a hit that they bet the farm and decided to make the focal point of Disneyland the castle of a princess whom the world didn't even know yet. When the park opened back in 1955, it was a sight to behold, this giant castle rising out of the rural landscape of Orange County. It was definitely the weenie that drew people into the park from the outside world. Walt's gamble really did pay off, and from a business perspective, it makes total sense. I mean, what's the greatest marketing in the world but to say, hey, look at this castle, and in a few years, you're going to be able to see who lives in that castle. That's an amazing, amazing piece of business, in my opinion.
It really is. And something else to note is I believe the Sleeping Beauty Castle was one of the first buildings to be completed in Disneyland while it was under construction. So I think that maybe gave workers a vision. They're like, okay, here's the castle. Let's set the tone. Now build, go and do likewise.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think that's pretty neat to note.
I think that's very cool.
So sometime between June and July of 1966, a coat of arms showed up in the castle. It displays three lions and is thought by many to be the Disney family coat of arms.
Now, again, this is controversial information at best. And I will say, I think this is the deepest nerd dive we'll ever take on the podcast, or have, at least up to this point.
Yeah, buckle up.
So,
yeah, this is some deep family research here on the Disney.
Oh, yes.
Disney clan.
Now, when researched, you find that the Disney family coat of arms can be also represented by three fleur-de-lis lined up next to one another. But the Disney coat of arms, when even further researched, can also be represented by three lions as well. So this is majorly confusing, and trust me, when you look through the research, there are many armchair historians who have been battling back and forth about the accuracy of this coat of arms for many, many moons.
So what is the final verdict on this?
Well, so let me preface this by saying that I am definitely in no way an expert on this, obviously, but I did do some extensive research to try to make sense of all this and see as close to the truth as I could possibly find. And one of the big things that I noticed, especially from people who had a lot more quote-unquote legitimate accolades when it came to their accuracy of this stuff, was they were saying that not every family was noble enough to actually have a coat of arms. So that definitely heavily plays into this. So keep that in mind. And I have a theory, though I am, like I said, by no means a genealogical or medieval history expert. So here are my thoughts. It's well known that the Disney family name is a derivation of the Norman French name Disney. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. But this...
I'm no Norman linguist, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, join the club, pal. This Disney family likely moved to England after the Norman invasion of 1066 AD, or CE. Because of political and religious upheaval, though, there were many who moved from England into the surrounding areas. The Disney family seemed to be one of these families. From what history we can find, the Disney family moved to Ireland from England. From there, Keppel Disney Jr. moved his family to America and fathered Elias, who fathered Walt Disney.
Wow, Al. That is some serious research into the Disney family archives, all the way, going all the way back to the Norman invitation. Well, what does this mean for the coat of arms hanging on the castle?
Well, I don't think it was the Norman invitation, because I don't think that the...
Sure, they invited everybody to a big picnic. That's history.
True. Well, I think they invited themselves to the English picnic.
There you go. Well, you heard it from the best foremost experts on Norman history.
Oh my word. We digress. So sorry. Hang with me, Harry, because the family moved from France to England to Ireland to America, and it's indeed possible, though highly, highly, highly unlikely, that the three lions' coat of arms could be claimed by the Disneys. But like I said, I don't think supporting the three lions as the Disney coat of arms is really valid at all, because what we do know is the three lion pattern is most notably found on one of the most famous family coats in all of history. This coat of arms flew over the reigns of the most notable English kings and queens from Richard the Lionheart all the way to King James. Because of the noble nature of the coat of arms, I believe it's very fair to say that this is not at all the coat of arms for the Disney family, but the coat of arms for the royal English lineage of the aforementioned prominent English families. Now, let me also put a caveat on that again, the reason why I say I can't say this with 100% accuracy is I don't know if any of these non-royal lineage families were able to either fly that banner over their own clan, family, whatever that may be, and take credit for it. But one of the things that I've also noticed a lot and seen criticism on is that there's a lot of people out there who are essentially charlatans who are willing to sell you a family crest or coat of arms that's basically completely arbitrary, but they pass it off as yours because there's really nobody who takes the time or has the ability to truly guess the accuracy of these things. So needless to say, for those people who probably just fast-forwarded through this entire nerd-tastic conversation, I would say that there's a way better chance that that is not the Disney coat of arms than it is the Disney coat of arms.
All right. So, but now it is because it's on the Disney castle and everybody looks at it and nobody knows those old English families. Everybody knows Disney.
That's very true. That's very true.
Though now that you have made a definitive statement like that, you do realize that the internet is required to bring a hateful firestorm upon you, right?
Oh, wait. Oh, I forgot about that. Okay, I take back my definitive statement. I take it back!
No, it doesn't work like that, Al. You can't unkick the hornet's nest. You just have to accept your fate.
And I will do so with dignity. It was a pleasure fighting alongside you, my dear.
Al! No!
Whoa. Harry, the internet swarm, it really wasn't so bad. Sure, at first those internet bees were vicious, but after about 2 to 4 seconds, the bees forgot about me and moved on to a new victim.
Oh, that's good to know for the internet swarm that is bound to attack during our Mr. Toad episode.
Oh, it totally is. Anyway, back to the coat of arms.
So we have mostly established that the coat of arms represents more of the family of Richard the Lionheart than Walter of Disney, but that leaves us with its mysterious and seemingly random appearance on the castle walls. Truthfully, as far as we have researched, there is no significance in the date or Disney era in which it was placed either. That is indeed still a mystery.
Harry, it would seem as though that swarm of internet bees is heading back this way.
Oh no. I made a crucial mistake and left a mystery unsolved. The swarm is bound to feast on that unsolved mystery until there's nothing left. I must protect the mystery with my life.
Harry, it's not worth the fight. Let the bees have this one. They need something to thrive off of. Just let it go.
Okay. Letting go of that mystery is actually pretty invigorating. I feel like a load has been lifted.
If only the internet bees knew the value of letting go and allowing some mysteries to go unsolved.
Wow, Al. Once again, we arrive at the nugget of truth at the end of this highly unnecessary aside. Well done.
I think that might be the most ridiculous aside we've ever taken. But getting back on track, the castle would remain the
same.
That's
debatable.
Yeah, that's very true. But the castle would remain the same until the mid-1970s, when in 1977, Earl-inspired dioramas were replaced by dioramas that shared the same style as the window displays on Main Street. For those unfamiliar with the style, think of well-designed dolls portraying some of the most pivotal moments in the story. Now, personally, I never saw these dioramas myself, but the images online make them look, in my humble opinion, a little bit creepy. Have you seen those pictures?
I honestly haven't. But I think that dolls used to be cute, and now they're not. There's too many movies where dolls are, you know, just wrecking things in terrible ways.
Oh, absolutely. Well, if you actually, listeners, if you want to jump over to our Facebook group, which you just search the Backside of Water podcast, you'll be able to find that one of our followers on there, one of our group members, who goes by the handle on Instagram as Skipper Freddy, so you should check him out over there. But he was able to post some pictures, and you can find links all over the place, but if you jump over onto our group page there, you'll see some pictures that he uploaded of those dioramas. For those of you who never got a chance to see them, you should probably check them out because they are a little bit unsettling, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, maybe that's... I mean, it's it feels like Disneyland, people who design it, do everything on purpose. So maybe that's just adding to the danger element of Fantasyland. I don't know.
Fear of the nightmare dolls.
Yeah, enjoy our little park. But don't let the dolls eat you.
Oh, man.
That's got to be a tagline for a movie coming out this summer, right?
At least it should be, and you should write it.
Well, if it does come out this summer, or a movie does come out, it's obviously, once again, because they listened to the Backside of Water.
People are just trolling this thing for any sort of idea.
Oh, totally, yeah. Any ideas come from this podcast, end of story. So Sleeping Beauty Castle would go unchanged for many decades until the 21st century. On October 7th, 2001, Sleeping Beauty Castle was abruptly closed down for undisclosed reasons. According to a lot of sources on the internet, there's a lot of evidence pointing to the fact that Sleeping Beauty Castle was one of the major targets for terrorists during the events surrounding September 11th. But that isn't the only thing that caused Sleeping Beauty Castle to go dormant. Yesterland.com claims that the closure was more likely caused by the fact that Sleeping Beauty Castle was an accessibility nightmare.
So the writer on that website goes on to talk about how even though exempt from a 1990 ADA law, Sleeping Beauty wasn't accessible by anybody with a disability, and this to the Walt Disney Company was a problem that needed to be solved. It was, according to Yesterland, this ADA issue that was one of the contributing factors to the closure of Sleeping Beauty Castle.
I also would really like to tip my hat to the Disney Company. They bend over backwards to make sure everybody has a good experience at their parks.
No, no question.
If you're in a wheelchair or something, they really, really take care of you, and I appreciate that. And that's something they're very accommodating and very gentle and very understanding of whatever disability an individual might have. They just are committed to having a magical time for everybody, and I really love that. So
no question.
Tip of the hat to Disney for that. So that same article on Yesterland also asserts that it was Disneyland's lowered income due to lower tourism levels after 9/11 that caused the closure of Sleeping Beauty's castle. Though the attraction didn't cost much to operate, it still did incur cost. And for a company that was hurting financially due to the dip in tourism, Yesterland believes that Sleeping Beauty Castle was one of the few attractions that could be shut down with relatively no fanfare due to its lack of popularity at the time.
Now, all three of these possibilities are valid for sure, and unfortunately, there is no way at this time to determine which one combination of issues was the true reason for closure. But its closure, despite what the Disney Company anticipated, did leave ripples in their fan base. And those ripples then led to rumors, which then led to all the conflicting things you have possibly heard or read. Regardless, from 2001 to 2008, the walkthrough portion of the castle was closed.
And the 50th anniversary of the park occurred during this time of closure for the walkthrough, but that didn't stop Imagineers from going all out when decorating the focal point of Disneyland. Lavish decorations and five of the turrets were topped with five crowns, each representing a decade in Disney history. And many of the spires and the castle were highlighted with 22-karat gold. The crown representing Disneyland's creation was decorated with Mickey ears, and the crown representing the New Tomorrowland of 1967 was adorned with rocket ships and planets. The crown representing the debut of the Main Street Electrical Parade and the showcases a blue fairy, and of course the crown representing the creation of Indiana Jones Adventure was covered with Mara's evil eye, and finally, the crown representing the 50th anniversary proudly displayed Tinkerbell and the world-famous fireworks.
That's a lot of information to cover, Harry. Very well done.
I didn't know that each of those spires represented something. I'll have to really look carefully for that next time I'm at the castle.
Well, and that's a good thing to say, though, is they actually still aren't up there anymore. It was only during that 50th anniversary time where you actually saw those up there. I was a little confused about that, too, and I had to look up some pictures online of those spires to see, but they were actually crowns that would adorn each one of the spires, not on the spires themselves.
Okay. So never mind, just Google pictures of it.
Yeah.
That's the best thing you can hope for at this point.
Now, I did remember reading somewhere that they do have one spire that still does have the 22-karat gold inlay on it. So I don't know. I'm going to the park in less than a month of recording this episode, so I'll have to look and report back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the gold trim, anywhere there's gold on that castle, it's real 22-karat gold leaf.
So if you're looking for, if you're looking to make some extra cash, just, you know where to go.
Yeah, you didn't hear it from us, though. Wink.
So 2008...
That would be the hardest way to get that gold if you were looking for a heist. I don't think that would even be possible.
I'm pretty sure it is a literal impossibility because they've got that. I mean, that castle right now, because of Pixar Fest, is guarded by Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah, don't mess with that.
He will follow you to infinity and beyond to get that gold back. That's why they hired the guy.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, sorry, man, we're really good at those today, those digressions. But in 2008, folks would see the reopening of a reimagined walkthrough experience that featured the original art styles inspired by Earl's pieces. Guests who were unable to access the walkthrough were treated with an immersive, interactive digital video version that was available in its own special area of the castle. That was to satisfy for the ADA requirements or the ADA accommodations. Now, this new walkthrough was so popular that on opening day of the attraction, the line reached to the middle of the hub.
And who wouldn't want to walk through that castle? For the 60th anniversary of the park, the spires and towers were adorned with diamonds and glitter and a large diamond denoting the 60th anniversary of the park. After some time, most of the decorations were removed, just like the 50th anniversary decorations. But as of this recording, the faux roof covering still remain as a reminder of the staying power of this beautiful example of architecture.
Very good. Now, this has been, man, this episode has been a little bit longer than a mini episode. I, like I said before, wasn't anticipating this becoming a mini episode that we would release, but we put a lot of research into this sucker, and so it's become this hulking behemoth. But now that we've gotten up to the modern day, I think it's time to wrap this thing up. So let's do this in style, shall we?
Let's do it.
Throughout the years, Sleeping Beauty Castle has been the main focus of hundreds of millions who have made their way down Main Street, USA. This beautiful behemoth has beckoned guests to venture further into the world that Walt built through its utter size, elegance, and mystique. There's a reason that Sleeping Beauty's castle is one of the most photographed buildings in the world. It represents the hopes, dreams, and imaginations not only of those who built it, but of all those who take the magical journey over its drawbridge, through its mighty structure, and into the world of fantasy.
And that is the story of Sleeping Beauty's castle. This was a great episode that Al and I learned a ton about the most beloved and recognizable icon of the Disney company. I mean, I don't know. Do you think the castle is more recognizable than Mickey Mouse?
I would say probably in the world of like pop culture and tourism, or in the world of pop culture, probably not, but in tourism, absolutely. I mean, that castle is world famous. The thing that I would say, though, is I would argue that castles are interchangeable, because one of the things we didn't cover is the other Magic Kingdom-influenced parks all have their own castles, and since we aren't covering those parks, one day maybe we'll talk about each one of those castles on like an episode of Did You Know Disney or something like that. But I would say for the most part, each one of the castles is kind of interchangeable to most people, that whether it's Sleeping Beauty or Snow White or... Cinderella, yeah. But each one of them... Wait, is there Snow White Castle? I thought... Is the one in Disneyland Paris, isn't that Snow White's castle?
You know, I'd have to double-check on that.
Yeah.
I know that they were originally thinking of making this Snow White's castle, but they ended up making this Sleeping Beauty castle.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't...
They ended up going with the Sleeping Beauty theme.
Quote me. I may have just misspoke there. But any one of the other Magic Kingdom castles, I think, could be interchangeable. But I would say that it's probably behind Mickey Mouse one of the most recognizable things. I would say that researching this episode made me appreciate the castle more than I ever have. I mean, honestly, it's one of those things that I love seeing as a symbol for what the park represents, but I've never really truly had an appreciation for the story behind that until I and both of us researched this castle. It was awesome and eye-opening. I can't believe also, Harry, that this is our 30th episode of the show. It's pretty awesome that we're able to mark our 30th actual episode in what everyone considers to be the center or middle of the park. This marks pretty much the halfway point in our journey.
Yes, it does. And I have some news. Al, I've had so much fun exploring Disneyland with you on this podcast and interacting with our incredible listeners. But this is my final episode as your co-host on The Backside of Water.
Wow. Do you mind if I ask why?
No, I don't at all. I'm glad you did. It was one of the hardest decisions I've made, to be honest. It is an absolute blast to talk about my favorite place in the world with my best friend, and let's be honest, the best listeners on this side of the rivers of America. This is an awesome podcast and a stellar community, and I am honored to be part of it. In our Frontierland episode, we say, sometimes you have to let go of something good to get something great. And yes, I'm quoting one of our previous episodes. Feel free to do the same. Anyway, one of the things I'm learning about life is that you need to give yourself the gifts that you need. And there's no precious gift, in my opinion, than time. I came to realize that I need to give myself time. I need to give myself time to listen and be still and be present. Because this moment, right now, is all any of us have. So between work and family, and by the way, I want to appreciate listeners spending their right now, their moment with us here on this podcast. Thank you so much. So between work and family, and I know this is true for many people, I only have about an hour of free time every day. So for the past 3 years, I filled that free time with researching, writing, and producing episodes of The Backside of Water, and I wouldn't trade that for the world. But moving forward, I need to give myself more time in my day to listen better, both to myself and the people I love. So it has been an incredibly difficult decision for me, but I'm embracing the butterflies that come with an uncertain future, and I'm happy to give myself the time I need for now.
Well, bro, I know that was a very, very tough choice, and for those of you who haven't been in our conversations behind the scenes, take my word for it that there has been a lot of conversation and a lot of tears that have gone into this decision on both of our parts. But I'm glad we got to do the show together as long as we did. So to commemorate Harry's time with us on The Backside of Water, we're going to do a very special farewell episode where we're going to go meet where our podcast started at the adventure. Oh man, excuse me, at the entrance to Adventureland.
I'm really excited. We're going to have a lot of fun in our upcoming farewell episode as we look back on the follies, gaffes, and foibles of our little podcast for the past 3 years. So be sure to tune in and learn what the real Alex Stewart is like. For example, did you know during our Haunted Mansion episode, he wouldn't respond unless I referred to him as the Gravedigger because he watched a clip of Monster Jam on TV?
You have no idea what a hot mess Harry is behind the scenes. And I will defend myself with the Gravedigger thing because I will still attest that there is no more show of pure strength and adrenaline than that little green goblin on wheels.
Fair enough. I mean, that it was apropos for the Haunted Mansion episode, definitely.
Well, and I've got some dirt too, Harry. If I recall during our...
Oh, really?
On our one-year retrospective episode, I remember you eating so many churros that you actually passed out in a food coma. I had to finish the episode alone. I had to impersonate Harry's voice through the entire last half of that episode, and that took real skill. Real skill.
Well, you know, I appreciate you covering for my very poor dietary decisions, but I thought we wouldn't tell people about that. But you know what? Those are just some of the antics that go on behind the scenes. So be sure to tune in to our next Farewell Harry episode. In the meantime, we'd really appreciate it if you took time to review our podcast on Apple Podcasts and checked us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We absolutely would. So, for the last time together, as you exit, please watch your head and watch your step.
And if you miss your step and hit your head, let me just savor this moment for a second. Please, watch your language. Bye.